Amazon, Apple, Microsoft, and China's Baidu have embarked on a worldwide hunt for terabytes of human speech, reports Bloomberg Businessweek. Microsoft has set up mock apartments in cities around the globe to record volunteers speaking in a home setting. The tech firms capture flows of talk from their smart devices and phones as they record and retain your words. Chinese search firm Baidu collects speech in every dialect. Then they take all that data and use it to teach their computers how to parse, understand, and respond to commands and queries. Pieces of your talk are regularly farmed out in bulk to third-party firms that conduct audio review processes in which virtual scorers, tasked to evaluate the degree of match between the machine's text and the original chunk of human speech, review audio recordings retained from smartphones, messaging apps, and digital assistants. Companies such as Amazon, Google, and Microsoft use these audio analyses to improve the algorithms of their voice systems. The tech companies insist that such recordings are anonymous, nothing more than voices without identities. Partners do not have the ability to tie the voice samples back to specific people, one Microsoft executive asserted. But one journalist who signed on to a virtual job as an audio recording analyst concluded just the opposite. As she listened to recordings full of pathos, intimacy, and easily identifiable personal information. Within the recordings themselves, users willingly surrender personal information. Information that is especially valuable in these review processes because they are so specific. Uncommon names, difficult to pronounce cities and towns, hyperlocal oddities. I heard people share their full names to initiate a call or offer up location-sensitive information while scheduling a doctor's appointment. The recordings capture people saying things they'd never want heard, regardless of anonymity. There isn't much to keep people who are listening to these recordings from sharing them. There is also substantial capital investment directed at talk, and Samsung's smart TV illustrates some of this behind-the-scenes action. Business forecasts routinely predict strong growth in the market for internet-enabled appliances, and Samsung is among a small group of market leaders. Its appliances use the Android operating system platform, and early on, the firm established alliances with both the Alphabet Google subsidiary Nest and with Cisco. "Our first mission is to bring your home to your connected life," a top executive explained in 2014. In 2015, privacy advocates discovered that the corporation's smart TVs were actually too smart, recording everything said in the vicinity of the TV. "Please pass the salt. We're out of laundry detergent. I'm pregnant. Let's buy a new car. We're going to the movies now. I have a rare disease. She wants a divorce. He needs a new lunchbox. Do you love me?" And sending all that talk to be transcribed by another market leader in voice recognition systems, Nuance Communications. The TV's surveillance policy, yes, even a TV has a surveillance policy now, reveals the layers of surveillance effort and commercial interest that operate outside of awareness in our homes. Samsung acknowledges that the voice commands aimed at triggering the TV's voice recognition capabilities are sent to a third party, and adds, "Please be aware that if your spoken words include personal or other sensitive information, that information will be among the data captured and transmitted to a third party through your use of voice recognition." Samsung disclaims responsibility for the policies of third-party firms, as nearly all surveillance policies do, including the one that actually collects and translates the talk of its unsuspecting customers. Samsung advises that you should exercise caution and review the privacy statements applicable to the third-party websites and services you use. The intrepid consumer determined to study these documents will find no succor in Nuance's privacy policy. Only the same catechism found in Samsung's and that of nearly every company. It also encourages you to read the privacy policies of the companies to whom it's selling your conversations, and so it goes. A forced march toward madness or surrender. In California, at least, the legislature passed a law prohibiting connected TVs from collecting voice data without prominently informing customers, and further outlawed the use of such data for third-party advertising. As we know from our examination of the dispossession cycle, however, the economic imperatives that drive surveillance capitalists to capture behavioral surplus are not easily deterred. By 2016, Samsung had doubled down on its smart TV-based secret rendition and behavioral surplus supply chains, positioning its new models as the hub of a new Samsung Smart Things smart home ecosystem in an open platform that supports thousands of devices, including fans, lights, thermostats, security cameras, and locks, and all within the aid of a single universal remote able to capture your every spoken command. In 2017, the FTC reached a $2.2 million settlement of a complaint initiated by the Office of the New Jersey Attorney General against Vizio, one of the world's largest manufacturers and distributors of internet-enabled smart televisions. Vizio's supply operations appear to be even more aggressive than Samsung's. Investigators discovered that, on a second-by-second basis, Vizio collected a selection of pixels on the screen that it matched to a database of TV, movie, and commercial content. The company then identified additional viewing data from cable or broadband service providers, set-top boxes, streaming devices, DVD players, and over-the-air broadcasts. All of this amounted to as much as 100 billion data points each day, just from the 11 million TVs identified in the settlement. Vizio disguised its supply operations behind a setting called smart interactivity, described to consumers as a feature that enables program offers and suggestions without any indication of its actual functions. In an unusually vivid blog post, the FTC describes Vizio's direct sales of this behavioral surplus. Vizio then turned that mountain of data into cash by selling consumers' viewing histories to advertisers and others. And let's be clear, we're not talking about summary information about national viewing trends. According to the complaint, Vizio got personal. The company provided consumers' IP addresses to data aggregators who then matched the address with an individual consumer or household. Vizio's contracts with third parties prohibited the re-identification of consumers and households by name, but allowed a host of other personal details, for example, sex, age, income, marital status, household size, education, and home ownership. And Vizio permitted these companies to track and target its consumers across devices. A concurring statement from FTC acting chairwoman Maureen K. Olhausen emphasized that the settlement broke new ground in its allegation that individualized television viewing activity falls within the definition of sensitive information that merits protection by the FTC. This finger in the dike would not hold back the tidal wave of similar incursions, as the prediction imperative cracks the whip to drive the hunt for unexplored pieces of talk from daily life. Rendition takes command of even the most benign supply sources, such as toys, which have now become toys that spy. A new breed of interactive dolls and toy robots, including a girl doll called My Friend Kayla, turned out to be supply hubs for underage behavioral surplus, subjecting young children and their parents' smartphones to ongoing surveillance without any meaningful data protection standards. The popular playthings, marketed by Genesis Toys, are bundled with a mobile application that, once downloaded to a smartphone, provides the data processing to enable the toy's ability to capture and understand whatever the child says. Along the way, the app accesses most of the phone's functions, including many that are irrelevant to the toy's operations, such as contact lists and the camera. The app establishes a Bluetooth connection that links the toy to the internet, and it records and uploads conversations as the toy actively engages the child in discussion. One doll targeted in the complaint systematically prompts children to submit a range of personal information, including where they live. The child's conversations are translated into text by third-party voice recognition software from, once again, Nuance Communications, and that information is used to retrieve answers to the child's questions using Google search and other web sources. Researchers discovered that the audio files of children's talk, Nuance calls them dialogue chunks, are uploaded to the company's servers where they are analyzed and stored. As you might expect, those dialogue chunks continue their journey as behavioral surplus in much the same way as Samsung's TV-captured audio, to be sold again and again for other services and products, as the Genesis Terms of Service Agreement indicates. Meanwhile, Mattel, one of the world's largest toy companies, was gaining ground with its innovations in interactive, internet-enabled, machine intelligence-powered toys, led by the new conversational Barbie doll and its Barbie Dreamhouse. The voice-activated smart dollhouse could respond to more than 100 commands, such as lower the elevator and turn on the disco ball, a new kind of habituation exercise aimed at normalizing ubiquity in intimate spaces. Barbie's new smart home is crushing it so hard, exulted Wired. Barbie's ultimate crib is voice-controlled. It's what a real smart home should be. Straight crushing it with universal voice control instead of a hodgepodge of disparate appliances hogging up app space on your phone. The future is served. In this future, children learn the principles of the one voice, a runtime, a new interface. It is available everywhere to execute their commands, anticipate their desires, and shape their possibilities. The omnipresence of the one voice, with its fractious, eager marketplace of you concealed under its skirts, changes many things. Intimacy, as we have known it, is compromised, if not eliminated. Solitude is deleted. The children will learn first that there are no boundaries between self and market. Later, they will wonder how it could ever have been different. When Mattel hired a new CEO in January 2017, it's no surprise that the company looked to Google, selecting its president for the Americas with responsibility for Google's commercial and advertising sales operations. Most analysts agreed that the appointment heralded Mattel's commitment to its innovations in internet-enabled toys and virtual reality. But the appointment underscores the shift in focus from making great products for you to collecting great data about you. The doll that was once a beloved mirror of a child's unfettered imagination, along with all the other toys in the toy box, and the box, and the room that hosts the box, and the house that hosts the room, are all earmarked for rendition, calculation, connection, and profit. No longer mere things, they are reinvented as vehicles for a horde of commercial opportunities, fabricated from our dialogue chunks and assorted gold dust. In 2017, Germany's Federal Network Agency banned the Kayla doll as an illegal surveillance device and urged parents to destroy any such dolls in their possession. In the U.S., the FTC had yet to take any action against the doll or Genesis toys. Meanwhile, the connected dollhouse prepares our children and families for the connected room, a project that Mattel announced in January 2017, and then 9 months later shelved amid an uproar from parents and privacy advocates, which paves the way for the connected home, whose purveyors hope will numb us to the connected world as we travel the path of ubiquity's manifest destiny and its promise of surveillance revenues. In pursuit of the what and the how of voice surplus, the logic of competition is to corner as much supply as possible. The urge toward totality generates competitive pressures to become the runtime and the new interface. The dominant, if not exclusive, medium through which we access and engage the apparatus as it engages us. It's a race to cover all the talk as a prerequisite for achieving the privileged status of the one voice, which will bestow upon the winner the ability to anticipate and monetize all the moments of all the people during all the days. The messianic urge toward totality and supremacy is evident in the rhetoric and strategies of key competitors in this race. Although Google, Microsoft, Amazon, and Samsung each have aspirations to dominate voice capture, it is Amazon, its machine learning assistant Alexa, and its expanding line of Echo Hubs and Dot speakers that offer the most telling case here. Alexa appears to be a threshold event that will define Amazon not only as an aggressive capitalist, but also as a surveillance capitalist. Amazon aggressively opened Alexa to third-party developers in order to expand the assistant's range of skills, such as reading a recipe or ordering a pizza. It also opened its platform to smart home device makers, from lighting systems to dishwashers, turning Alexa into a single voice for controlling your home systems and appliances. In 2015, Amazon announced that Alexa would be sold as a service known as Amazon Lex, enabling any company to integrate Alexa's brain into its products. Amazon Lex is described as a service for building conversational interfaces into any application using voice and text. Lex enables you to define entirely new categories of products. As Alexa's senior vice president explained, "Our goal is to try to create a kind of open, neutral ecosystem for Alexa and make it as pervasive as we possibly can." By 2018, Amazon had inked deals with home builders, installing its Dot speakers directly into ceilings throughout the house, as well as Echo devices and Alexa-powered door locks, light switches, security systems, doorbells, and thermostats. As one report put it, Amazon can acquire more comprehensive data on people's living habits. The company wants to sell real-world services such as house cleaning, plumbing, and restaurant delivery. But according to some insiders, the vision is more far-reaching. An omniscient voice that knows all experience and anticipates all action. Already, forward-looking Amazon patents include the development of a voice sniffer algorithm, integrated into any device and able to respond to hot words such as bought, dislike, or love with product and service offers. Amazon is on the hunt for behavioral surplus. This explains why the company joined Apple and Google in the contest for your car's dashboard, forging alliances with Ford and BMW. Shopping from the steering wheel means hosting behavioral futures markets in your front seat. Alexa is ready with restaurant recommendations or advice on where to get your tires checked. As pervasive as possible explains why Amazon wants its Echo Alexa device to also function as a home phone, able to make and receive calls, why it inked an agreement to install Echo in nearly 5,000 rooms of the Wynn Resort in Las Vegas, and why it is selling Alexa to call centers to automate the process of responding to live questions from customers by phone and text. Each expansion of Alexa's territory increases the volume of voice surplus accrued to Amazon's servers and fed to Alexa. The path to the coronation of the one voice is not an easy one, and there are other travelers determined to elbow their way to the finish line. Google also wants its personal assistant Google Home to double as your home phone. Samsung reappears as another contender with its acquisition of Viv, a powerful new voice system designed by the original developers of Apple's personal assistant, Siri, who were frustrated with the constraints of Apple's approach. Viv's lead developer explained that you can get things done by talking to things, a marketplace that will become the next big area. If life is a wild horse, then the digital assistant is one more means by which that horse is to be broken by rendition. Unruly life is brought to heel, rendered as behavioral data, and reimagined as a territory for browsing, searching, knowing, and modifying. Just as surveillance capitalism transformed the web into a market onslaught fueled by the capture and analysis of behavioral surplus, so everyday life is set to become a mere canvas for the explosion of a new, always-on market cosmos dedicated to our behavior and from which there is no escape. 2. Rendition of the self. We are used to face-to-face interaction where words disappear. I assumed that keyboard communication was like a letter or a phone call, but now I understand that it doesn't disappear. The myth is that electronic communication is invisible. He was a brilliant research scientist at a large pharmaceuticals company that I called Drug Corp in my 1988 book, In the Age of the Smart Machine. I had spent several years visiting the research group there as they shifted much of their daily communications from face-to-face meetings to Dialog, one of the world's first computer conferencing systems. Dialog was a precursor to a technology that we now call social media. The Dialog platform created a new social space in which the scientific community at Drug Corp elaborated and extended their networks of relationships, access to information, thoughtful dialogue, and social banter, as I described it then. They embraced dialogue with great enthusiasm, but it did not end well. In time, I wrote, it became clear that they had also unwittingly exposed once evanescent and intangible aspects of their social exchange to an unprecedented degree of hierarchical scrutiny. The interviews that stretched across those years documented the scientists' gradual awakening to new dangers as dimensions of personal experience that were implicit and private suddenly became explicit and public in ways that they did not anticipate and with consequences that they lamented deeply. Thanks to the new computer-mediated milieu, the scientists' social and professional conversations now appeared as an electronic text, visible, knowable, shareable. It enriched their work in many ways, but it also created unexpected vulnerabilities as dispositions, values, attitudes, and social interactions were recast as objects of scrutiny. In a series of conflicts that unfolded over the years, I watched as the managers and executives at Drug Corp were simply unable to quell their inclination to use the next social text as a means to evaluate, critique, and punish. On more than one occasion, I learned of managers who had printed out pages of dialogue conversations in order to spread them out on the floor and analyze opinions on a particular subject, sometimes actually taking scissors to the pages and organizing the entries by theme or person. In many cases, these investigations were pure fact-gathering, but in other instances, managers wanted to identify the individuals who agreed with or opposed their directives. The enduring witness of the text was adapted as a medium through which managers attempted to control and channel what had always been the most ephemeral aspects of subordinates' behavior. All the original excitement and promise melted into cynicism and anxiety as the scientists gradually withdrew from dialogue, opting instead for a routine email application and a preference for more perfunctory, impersonal messages. Decades later, the children and grandchildren of those scientists, along with most of us, communicate freely through our smartphones and social media, unaware that we are reliving the bitter lessons of Drug Corp, but now at an entirely new level of rendition. The scientists were rattled to see their casual talk reified and converted into an object of hierarchical inspection. Now the interiors of our lives, simplistically summarized as personality or emotions, are recast as raw material available to anyone who can make, or buy a new generation of supply chain accessories and the means of production to analyze this new genus of behavioral surplus and fabricate extremely lucrative prediction products. Personalization is once again the euphemism that spearheads this generation of prediction products manufactured from the raw materials of the self. These innovations extend the logic of earlier iterations of dispossession, from web crawling to reality crawling to life crawling to self crawling. As has been the case in each iteration, insights and techniques once intended to illuminate and enrich quickly disappear into the magnetic field of the commercial surveillance project, only to reappear later as ever more cunning methods of supply, manufacture, and sales. The 2 billion and counting Facebook users are the most poignant descendants of drug corps scientists. Many of them joined Facebook to escape the pervasive hierarchical oversight of workplace communications that had become routine in the years since drug corps' first experiments. Facebook, they once thought, was our place, as benign and taken for granted as the old Ma Bell, a necessary utility for association, communication, and participation. Instead, Facebook became one of the most authoritative and threatening sources of predicted behavioral surplus from the depths. With a new generation of research tools, it learned to plunder your self-right through your most intimate core. New supply operations can render as measurable behavior everything from the nuances of your personality to your sense of time, sexual orientation, intelligence, and scores of other personal characteristics. The corporation's immense machine intelligence capabilities transform these data into vivid prediction products. The stage was set for the discovery of your Facebook profile's easy pillage in 2010, when a collaboration of German and U.S. scholars came to the unexpected conclusion that Facebook profiles are not idealized self-portraits, as many had assumed. Instead, they found that the information on Facebook reflects the user's actual personality, as independently assessed by the well-validated protocols of the five-factor personality model, and as compared to study participants' own descriptions of their ideal self. There is compelling evidence to suggest that the unique dynamics of the Facebook milieu eventually complicated this picture of real personality, as we shall explore in Chapter 16. But in 2011, these early findings encouraged three University of Maryland researchers to take the next logical step. They developed a method that relies on sophisticated analytics and machine intelligence to accurately predict a user's personality from publicly available information in his or her Facebook profile. In the course of this research, the team came to appreciate the magic of behavioral surplus, discovering, for example, that a person's disclosure of specific personal information, such as religion or political affiliation, contributes less to a robust personality analysis than the fact that the individual is willing to share such information in the first place. This insight alerted the team to a new genre of powerful behavioral metrics. Instead of analyzing the content of user lists, such as favorite TV shows, activities, and music, they learned that simple metadata, such as the amount of information shared, turned out to be much more useful and predictive than the original raw data. The computations produced on the strength of these behavioral metrics, when combined with automated linguistic analysis and internal Facebook statistics, led the research team to conclude that we can predict a user's score for a personality trait to within just more than one-tenth of its actual value. The University of Maryland team began what would become a multi-year journey toward the instrumentalization of data from the depths for the purposes of a highly intentional program of manipulation and behavioral modification. Although they could not see very far down that road, they nevertheless anticipated the utility of their findings for an eager audience of surveillance capitalists. With the ability to infer a user's personality, social media websites, E-commerce retailers, and even ad servers can be tailored to reflect the user's personality traits and present information such that users will be most receptive to it. The presentation of Facebook ads could be adjusted based on the personality of the user. Product reviews from authors with personality traits similar to the user could be highlighted to increase trust and perceived usefulness. The new capabilities also proved robust when applied to the other sources of social media metadata. Later that year, the Maryland team published findings that used publicly available Twitter data to predict scores of each of the five personality dimensions to within 11% to 18% of their actual value. Similar research findings would become central to the progress of rendering Facebook profiles as behavior for new caches of surplus from the depths. In the UK, a team of researchers, including Cambridge University's Mikhail Kozinski and the deputy director of Cambridge's Psychometrics Center, David Stillwell, built on this line of research. Stillwell had already developed the My Personality database, a third-party Facebook application that allows users to take psychometric tests, like those based on the five-factor model, and receive feedback on their results. Launched in 2007 and hosted at the Psychometrics Center, by 2016, the database contained more than 6 million personality profiles, complemented by 4 million individual Facebook profiles. Once regarded as a unique, if offbeat, source of psychological data, My Personality had become the database of choice for the scoping, standardization, and validation of the new models capable of predicting personality values from ever smaller samples of Facebook data and metadata. Later, it would become the model for the work of a small consultancy called Cambridge Analytica, which used the new caches of behavioral surplus for an onslaught of politically inspired behavioral micro-targeting. In a 2012 paper, Kozinski and Stillwell concluded that user personality can be easily and effectively predicted from public data, and warned that social media users are dangerously unaware of the vulnerabilities that follow their innocent but voluminous personal disclosures. Their discussion specifically cited Facebook CEO's Mark Zuckerberg's unilateral upending of established privacy norms in 2010, when he famously announced that Facebook users no longer have an expectation of privacy. Zuckerberg had described the corporation's decision to unilaterally release users' personal information, declaring, "We decided that these would be the social norms now, and we just went for it." Despite their misgivings, the authors went on to suggest the relevance of their findings for marketing, user interface design, and recommender systems. In 2013, another provocative study by Kozinski, Stillwell, and Microsoft's Tory Grapel revealed that Facebook likes could automatically and accurately estimate a wide range of personal attributes that people would typically assume to be private, including sexual orientation, ethnicity, religious and political views, personality traits, intelligence, happiness, use of addictive substances, parental separation, age, and gender. The authors appeared increasingly ambivalent about the social implications of their work. On the one hand, they announced that these new predictive capabilities could be used to improve numerous products and services. They concluded that online businesses can adjust their behavior to match each user's personality, with marketing and product recommendations psychologically tailored to each individual. But the authors also warned that automated prediction engines run by companies, governments, or Facebook itself can compute millions of profiles without individual consent or awareness, discovering facts that an individual may not have intended to share. The researchers cautioned that one can imagine situations in which such predictions, even if incorrect, could pose a threat to an individual's well-being, freedom, or even life. Despite these ethical quandaries, by 2015, Kozinski had moved to Stanford University, first to the computer science department and then to the Graduate School of Business, where his research quickly attracted funding from the likes of Microsoft, Boeing, Google, the National Science Foundation, and the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, DARPA. Kaczynski and a variety of collaborators, often including Stilwell, went on to publish a succession of articles that elaborated and extended the capabilities demonstrated in the early papers, refining procedures that quickly and cheaply assess large groups of participants with minimal burden. A paper published in 2015 broke fresh ground again by announcing that the accuracy of the team's computer predictions had equaled or outpaced that of human judges, both in the use of Facebook likes to assess personality traits based on the five-factor model, and to predict life outcomes such as life satisfaction, substance abuse, or depression. The study made clear that the real breakthrough of the Facebook prediction research was the achievement of economies in the exploitation of these most intimate behavioral depths, with automated, accurate, and cheap personality assessment tools that effectively target a new class of objects, once known as your personality. That these economies can be achieved outside the awareness of unrestrained animals makes them even more appealing. As one research team emphasizes, the traditional method for personality evaluation is extremely costly in terms of time and labor, and it cannot acquire customer personality information without their awareness. Personality analysis for commercial advantage is built on behavioral surplus. The so-called metadata, or mid-level metrics, honed and tested by researchers and destined to foil anyone who thinks that she is in control of the amount of personal information that she reveals in social media. In the name of, for example, affordable car insurance, we must be coded as conscientious, agreeable, and open. This is not easily faked because the surplus retrieved for analysis is necessarily opaque to us. We are not scrutinized for substance, but for form. The price you are offered does not derive from what you write about, but how you write it. It is not what is in your sentences, but in their length and complexity. Not what you list, but that you list. Not the picture, but the choice of filter and degree of saturation. Not what you disclose, but how you share or fail to. Not where you make plans to see your friends, but how you do so. A casual later or a precise time and place. Exclamation marks and adverb choices operate as revelatory and potentially damaging signals of yourself. That the personality insights themselves are banal should not distract us from the fact that the volume and depth of the new surplus supplies enabled by these extraction operations are unprecedented. Nothing like this has ever been conceivable. As Kaczynski told an interviewer in 2015, few people understand that companies such as Facebook, Snapchat, Microsoft, Google, and others have access to data that scientists would not ever be able to collect. Data scientists have successfully predicted traits on the five-factor personality model with surplus culled from Twitter profile pictures, color, composition, image type, demographic information, facial presentation and expression, selfies, color, photographic styles, visual texture, and Instagram photos, hue, brightness, saturation. Others have tested alternative algorithmic models and personality constructs. Another research team demonstrated the ability to predict satisfaction with life from Facebook messages. This new world has no manager on his or her hands and knees scissoring pages of computer conferencing messages into thematically organized piles of paper scraps. It's not the office floor that is crawled. It is you. In his 2015 interview, Kaczynski observed that all of our interactions are being mediated through digital products and services, which basically means that everything is being recorded. He even characterized his own work as pretty creepy. I actually want to stress that I think that many of the things that one can do should certainly not be done by corporations or governments without users' consent. Recognizing the woefully asymmetric division of learning, he lamented the refusals of Facebook and the other internet firms to share their data with the general public, concluding that it's not because they're evil, but because the general public is bloody stupid. As a society, we lost the ability to convince large companies that have enormous budgets and enormous access to data to share this goodness with us. We should basically grow up finally and stop it. In capitalism, though, latent demand summons suppliers and supplies. Surveillance capitalism is no different. The prediction imperative unleashes the surveillance hounds to stalk behavior from the depths, and well-intentioned researchers unwittingly oblige, leaving a trail of cheap, push-button raw meat for surveillance capitalists to hunt and devour. It did not take long. By early 2015, IBM announced that its Watson personality service was open for business. The corporation's machine intelligence tools are even more complex and invasive than those used in most academic studies. In addition to the five-factor personality model, IBM assesses each individual across 12 categories of needs, including excitement, harmony, curiosity, ideal, closeness, self-expression, liberty, love, practicality, stability, challenge, and structure. It then identifies values, defined as motivating factors which influence a person's decision-making across five dimensions: self-transcendence and helping others, conservation and tradition, hedonism and taking pleasure in life, self-enhancement and achieving success, and open to change and excitement. IBM promises limitless applications of its new surplus supplies and deeper portraits of individual customers. As we would expect, these operations are tested among captive employees who, once habituated, can become docile members of a behaviorally purified society. Personality correlates can now be identified that predict the precise ways in which each consumer will react to marketing efforts. Who will redeem a coupon? Who will purchase which product? The corporation says that social media content and behavior can be used to capitalize on targeted revenue-generating opportunities, with mapping rules from personality to behavior. The messaging and approach of customer service agents, insurance agents, travel agents, real estate agents, investment brokers, and so on can be matched to the personality of the customer, with those psychological data displayed to the agent at the precise moment of contact. IBM's research demonstrates that agents who express personality traits associated with agreeableness and conscientiousness produce significantly higher levels of customer satisfaction. It is common sense, except that now these interactions are measured and monitored in real time and at scale, with a view to rewarding or extinguishing behavior according to its market effect. Thanks to Rendition, a handful of now measurable personality characteristics, including the need for love, predict the likelihood of liking a brand. In a Twitter-targeted ad experiment, IBM found that it could significantly increase click-through rates and follow rates by targeting individuals with high openness and low neuroticism scores on the five-factor personality analysis. In another study, IBM rendered behavioral data from 2,000 Twitter users to establish metrics such as response rates, activity levels, and elapsed time between tweets, in addition to psycholinguistic analyses of tweets and five-factor personality analysis. IBM trained its predictive model by asking the 2,000 users either location-related or product-related questions. The findings showed that personality information predicted the likelihood of responses. People whom the machines rated as moral, trusting, friendly, extroverted, and agreeable tended to respond, compared to low response rates from people rated as cautious and anxious. Many of the characteristics that we try to teach our children and model in our own behavior are simply repurposed as dispossession opportunities for hidden machine processes of rendition. In this new world, paranoia and anxiety function as sources of protection from machine invasion for profit. Must we teach our children to be anxious and suspicious? IBM is not alone, of course. An innovative breed of personality mercenaries quickly set to work institutionalizing the new supply operations. Their efforts suggest how quickly we lose our bearings as institutionalization first establishes a sense of normalcy and social acceptance, and then gradually produces the numbness that accompanies habituation. This process begins with business plans and marketing messages, new products and services, and journalistic representations that appear to accept the new facts as given. Among this new cohort of mercenaries was Cambridge Analytica, the UK consulting firm owned by the reclusive billionaire and Donald Trump backer Robert Mercer. The firm's CEO, Alexander Nix, boasted of its application of personality-based microbehavioral targeting in support of the Leave and the Trump campaigns during the ramp-up to the 2016 Brexit vote and the U.S. presidential election. Nix claimed to have data resolved to an individual level where we have somewhere close to 4,000 or 5,000 data points on every adult in the United States. While scholars and journalists tried to determine the truth of these assertions and the role that these techniques might have played in both 2016 election upsets, the firm's new chief revenue officer quietly announced the firm's less glamorous but more lucrative post-election strategy. After this election, it'll be full tilt into the commercial business. Writing in a magazine for car dealers just after the U.S. election, he tells them that his new analytic methods reveal how a customer wants to be sold to, what their personality type is, and which methods of persuasion are most effective. What it does is change people's behavior through carefully crafted messaging that resonates with them. It only takes small improvements in conversion rates for a dealership to see a dramatic shift in revenue. A leaked Facebook document acquired in 2018 by The Intercept illustrates the significance of data drawn from the depths in the fabrication of Facebook's prediction products, confirms the company's primary orientation to its behavioral futures markets, and reveals the degree to which Cambridge Analytica's controversial practices reflected standard operating procedures at Facebook. The confidential document cites Facebook's unparalleled machine learning expertise aimed at meeting its customers' core business challenges. To this end, it describes Facebook's ability to use its unrivaled and highly intimate data stores to predict future behavior, targeting individuals on the basis of how they will behave, purchase, and think, now, soon, and later. The document links prediction, intervention, and modification. For example, a Facebook service called Loyalty Prediction is touted for its ability to analyze behavioral surplus in order to predict individuals who are at risk of shifting their brand allegiance. The idea is that these predictions can trigger advertisers to intervene promptly, targeting aggressive messages to stabilize loyalty, and thus achieve guaranteed outcomes by altering the course of the future. Facebook's prediction engine is built on a new machine intelligence platform called FB Learner Flow, which the company describes as its new AI backbone and the key to personalized experiences that deliver the most relevant content. The machine learning system ingests trillions of data points every day, trains thousands of models, either offline or in real time, and then deploys them to the server fleet for live predictions. The company explains that since its inception, more than 1 million models have been trained, and our prediction service has grown to make more than 6 million predictions per second. As we have already seen, personalization derives from prediction. and prediction derives from ever-richer sources of behavioral surplus and therefore even more ruthless rendition operations. Indeed, the confidential document cites some of the key raw materials fed into this high-velocity, high-volume, and deeply scoped manufacturing operation, including not only location, Wi-Fi network details, and device information, but also data from videos, analyses of affinities, details of friendships, and similarities with friends. It was probably no coincidence that the leaked Facebook presentation appeared around the same time that a young Cambridge Analytica mastermind-turned-whistleblower, Chris Wiley, unleashed a torrent of information on that company's secret efforts to predict and influence individual voting behavior, quickly riveting the world on the small political analytics firm and the giant source of its data, Facebook. There are many unanswered questions about the legality of Cambridge Analytica's complex subterfuge, its actual political impact, and its relationship with Facebook. Our interest here is restricted to how its machinations shine a bright light on the power of surveillance capitalism's mechanisms, especially the determination to render data from the depth dimension. Kaczynski and Stilwell had called attention to the commercial value of their methods, understanding that surplus from the depths afforded new possibilities for behavioral manipulation and modification. Wiley recounts his fascination with this prospect, and, through a complicated chain of events, it was he who persuaded Cambridge Analytica to use Kaczynski and Stilwell's data to advance its owner's political aims. The objective was behavioral micro-targeting, influencing voters based not on their demographics, but on their personalities. When negotiations with Kaczynski and Stilwell broke down, a third Cambridge academic, Alexander Kogan, was hired to render a similar cache of Facebook personality data. Kogan was well known to Facebook. He had collaborated with its data scientists on a 2013 project in which the company provided data on 57 billion friendships. This time, he paid approximately 270,000 people to take a personality quiz. Unknown to these participants, Kogan's app enabled him to access their Facebook profiles, and, on average, the profiles of about 160 of each of the test takers' friends, none of whom would have known or had reason to suspect this invasion. It was a massive rendition operation from which Kogan successfully produced psychological profiles of somewhere between 50 and 87 million Facebook users, data that he then sold to Cambridge Analytica. When Facebook questioned him about his application, Kogan vowed that his research was solely for academic purposes. Indeed, mutual respect between the two parties was sufficiently robust that Facebook hired one of Kogan's assistants to join its in-house team of research psychologists. "We exploited Facebook to harvest millions of people's profiles," Wiley admitted, "and built models to exploit what we knew about them and target their inner demons." His summary of Cambridge Analytica's accomplishments is a précis of the surveillance capitalist project, and a rationale for its determination to render from the depths. These are the very capabilities that have gathered force over the nearly two decades of surveillance capitalism's incubation in lawless space. These practices produced outrage around the world, when in fact they are routine elements in the daily elaboration of surveillance capitalism's methods and goals, both at Facebook and within other surveillance capitalist companies. Cambridge Analytica merely reoriented the surveillance capitalist machinery from commercial markets in behavioral futures toward guaranteed outcomes in the political sphere. It was Eric Schmidt, not Wiley, who first pried open this Pandora's box, paving the way for the transfer of surveillance capitalism's core mechanisms to the electoral process as he cemented the mutual affinities that produced surveillance exceptionalism. In fact, Wiley enjoyed his early training under Obama's director of targeting. Schmidt's now weaponized innovations have become the envy of every political campaign, and, more dangerously, of every enemy of democracy. In addition to employing surveillance capitalism's foundational mechanisms, rendition, behavioral surplus, machine intelligence, prediction products, economies of scale, scope, and action, Cambridge Analytica's dark adventure also exemplifies surveillance capitalism's tactical requirements. Its operations were designed to produce ignorance through secrecy and the careful evasion of individual awareness. Wiley calls this information warfare, correctly acknowledging the asymmetries of knowledge and power that are essential to the means of behavioral modification. I think it's worse than bullying because people don't necessarily know it's being done to them. At least bullying respects the agency of people because they know. If you do not respect the agency of people, anything that you're doing after that point is not conducive to a democracy. And fundamentally, information warfare is not conducive to democracy. This warfare and its structure of invasion and conquest represent surveillance capitalism's standard operating procedures to which billions of innocents are subjected each day, as rendition operations violate all boundaries and modification operations claim dominion over all people. Surveillance capitalism imposes this quid pro quo of agency as the price of information and connection, continuously pushing the envelope of rendition to new frontiers. Along the way, companies such as Facebook and Google employ every useful foot soldier, including social scientists such as Kogan, who are willing to put their shoulders to the wheel as they help the company learn, perfect, and integrate the cutting-edge methods that can conquer the next frontier, a phenomenon that we will visit in more depth in Chapter 10. Irrespective of Cambridge Analytica's actual competence and its ultimate political impact, the plotting and planning behind its ambitions are testament to the pivotal role of rendition from the depths in the prediction and modification of behavior, always in pursuit of certainty. Billionaires such as Zuckerberg and Mercer have discovered that they can muscle their way to dominance of the division of learning in society by setting their sights on these rendition operations and the fortunes they tell. They aim to be unchallenged in their power to know, to decide who knows, and to decide who decides. The rendition of personality was an important milestone in this quest. A frontier, yes, but not the final frontier. 3. Machine emotion. In 2015, an 8-year-old startup named Realize won a €3.6 million grant from the European Commission for a project codenamed SEWA, Automatic Sentiment Analysis in the Wild. The aim was to develop automated technology that will be able to read a person's emotion when they view content and then establish how this relates to how much they liked the content. The director of video at AOL International called the project a huge leap forward in video ad tech and the holy grail of video marketing. Just a year later, Realize won the Commission's Horizon 2020 Innovation Prize thanks to its machine learning-based tools that help market researchers analyze the impact of their advertising and make it more relevant. The SEWA project is a window on a burgeoning new domain of rendition and behavioral surplus supply operations, known as effective computing, emotion analytics, and sentiment analysis. The personalization project descends deeper toward the ocean floor with these new tools, where they lay claim to yet a new frontier of rendition, trained not only on your personality, but also on your emotional life. If this project of surplus from the depths is to succeed, then your unconscious, where feelings form before there are words to express them, must be recast as simply one more source of raw material supply for machine rendition and analysis, all of it for the sake of more perfect prediction. As a market research report on effective computing explains, Knowing the real-time emotional state can help businesses to sell their product and thereby increase revenue. Emotion analytics products such as Sewa use specialized software to scour faces, voices, gestures, bodies, and brains, all of it captured by biometric and depth sensors, often in combination with imperceptibly small, unobtrusive cameras.